Good evening and welcome to The Laundry List on 90.5 CFCR. And you just heard Josh Ritter's song, Where the Night Goes. And tonight I have with me Rachel Engler-Stringer, who chose that song. And we're going to talk a little bit about what she does in her job as an associate professor in community health and epidemiology at the University of Saskatchewan. And we're going to talk a little bit about her trip to Uganda and food security, food and health and nutrition and all those things that is actually how Rachel and I met. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
So you're an associate professor at community health and epidemiology. So what type of projects are you into and what research are you doing right now?
So when I was hired in our department in 2009, I was hired as a community-based health researcher, and I would say that still really characterizes what I do. So mm-hmm. My interests are related to food and food security and food access. So food security, both at the household level, so meaning people's ability to have sufficient quantity, quality of food, and acquire in a way that is socially acceptable. So that's at the household level, and then also at the community level. So looking at how communities access food, looking at also the sustainability of the food system, both mm-hmm. Environmental sustainability and social sustainability. So broadly, that's kind of where my work, my research is sort of positioned. And in terms of the actual projects that I do, there's a few of them on the go at all times. And I try really hard to respond to mm-hmm. Different organizations, sometimes individuals coming to me with a problem that they would like some research to be done on mm-hmm. and trying to respond to those needs.
So, and responding to people asking you to do interviews for them, like me.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes what will happen is a practitioner or a community-based organization will come and will say, you know, these are some things that we want to know more about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are you interested in studying that? And then what we'll try to do is kind of conceptualize a project that suits their needs as well as fulfills my sort of obligations in terms of my academic position. Mm-hmm. So I think probably the research that a number of people have heard about in the last little while was I was the leader of the person study of the group studying the impacts of the Good Food Junction mm-hmm. Cooperative grocery store mm-hmm. On the community in which it was situated. Mm-hmm. So I have spent that research is actually ongoing, even though the store itself has now closed.
Yikes. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that too.
Absolutely. I've recently projects that I'm engaged in are things like we implemented a survey on the university campus looking at household food security amongst university students at the University of Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. Interested in the kinds of struggles that students are facing when it comes to having sufficient funds to acquire what it is they need, you know, to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And then a whole bunch of other projects right now. We've got some follow-up research to the Good Food Junction research. Right now we're doing a in-depth study of people who living in the inner city primarily. It's ethnographic research, so following households for about a year and really getting to know with a lot of detail how they sort of engage with accessing food and food mm-hmm. practices, and some really interesting follow-up from our Good Food Junction research where we found that people are accessing food in really complex ways. Mm-hmm. So everything from going to the grocery store to family members who live in the north and hunt and butcher animals mm-hmm. and send to the city, to using CHEP Good Food Boxes, to going to the farmer's market, all sometimes in the same families. So quite kind of complex sort of ways of accessing food. And mm-hmm. so we're trying to get a better understanding of that.
Okay.
So I've got a whole bunch of things in the go. So maybe rather than me tell you about a whole bunch of them all at once, maybe we could kind of, well, start with one thing and we'll go from there, I guess.
Okay. for those of you who don't know, our listeners, I'm Lisa, by the way. I didn't introduce myself, but I do food research too. My angle's more from a policy angle, and I look at the social and economic dimensions. So a lot of the stuff that Rachel and I research are complementary, I would say. And we actually, it was funny because we met at a food conference in Victoria, I think.
I think we may have met before that.
And then we met, and then we didn't even realize we were at the same university, which is ridiculous. And I'm thinking, I remember we were sitting on that bus, and we were talking about why is the food research community not better integrated at the U of S? Like, because there's so many people doing so many different things, like nutrition, health, economics, social policy, etc. So for listeners who, when they hear the word food security, they're like, what is that? Does that just mean like you have enough food to eat, and don't we have enough food in Canada? Like, how would you define it differently than, say, I don't know, a common definition of just like having enough food to eat and not being hungry?
So the definition that I work from is one that's really focused on having the means, the economic means. So having enough money to buy food. So it's really very much interlinked with poverty. So in terms of the way that that Health Canada or Stats Canada through the Canadian Community Health Survey, because they're the ones who kind of monitor household food security in this country, they're interested. That's kind of the definition that I use, although I often integrate a lot broader kind of perspective, so bringing in aspects of social justice, control over the food system, bringing in environmental sustainability and those kinds of things. But to kind of define it really, really narrowly, it's really just those four kind of dimensions. So quantitatively, having enough food, which is the very basics, right? And there are not very many people in this country who would struggle to not, in terms of quantity of food. It's a relatively small number of people. And I mean strictly calories speaking. But when we're talking about quality, which is that second dimension, it becomes much more complex, and there's a much larger number of people in this country who struggle to have sufficient quality. So you may be able to get enough calories to fill your belly, but are you able to buy foods that are nutritious? Are you able to buy foods that meet your particular dietary needs? Depending on, there's lots of differences around that. And then the social and the psychological elements, I think, to me, are also really important. So meaning both how you access food. Are you needing to go to the food bank in order to feed your family? That's not socially acceptable. There's a lot of shame associated with that.
Stigma.
That a person who's going to the food bank is by definition not going to be food secure, although people who go to the food bank are usually the tip of the iceberg when it comes to food insecurity in this country.
And I think that's a huge misperception. There was a conference, and I can't remember the name, but there was a conference like a few months ago, and that was the big takeaway that I
the global health one on. Really, food bank access is very much the tip of the iceberg. So the people who will go to the food bank are actually in some ways quite different than the broader population of people who are food insecure. So you will find people who go to the food bank who are you will find families with children overrepresented at the food bank, and that makes perfect sense. As a parent, the last thing you want is for your child to go hungry. And so oftentimes you will get yourself to the point of going to the food bank and doing that you might not do that if you didn't have kids, just because you're concerned about your kids being able to have enough food. I would say what it's probably the best indication of is some of the most severe situations. Although, again, even not always. Like, it's not, there's actually a lot of variation in people who choose to go to the food bank. And there's not a ton of really clear characteristics of people other than, having kids as a common reason to end up going to the food bank, because as a parent, it's the last thing you want to do. I mean, same as mothers in particular, but parents both sacrificing to feed their kids. So in a household that's food insecure, usually the child would be the last person to be food insecure, so the mother would be first. mothers tend to feed their kids before they feed themselves in right. situations of food poverty, and then we'll eat last, and so we'll be often the first ones to go hungry in a household.
So what could you tell us a little bit more about food insecurity in Saskatoon? What's the situation here? Because I think a lot of people, it might be very invisible to a lot of people that there are yeah. people in need here. And what did you refer to, food poverty? Is that what you called it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, just trying to link food insecurity to the economic situation yeah. that people are in. So in terms of Saskatoon, I mean, just statistically, like just to start with the basics.
Yeah, like what is your research yeah, found?
Well, I mean, what we know from national research and then that's been broken down to the community level in Saskatoon, Saskatoon's right in the median. Actually right in the mean. I think it's 12.7% of people are considered food insecure in Saskatoon. And there's variations in terms of severity of that.
Okay.
So just the very basic, start with that. In terms of my own research, what I do is not necessarily looking at the city level. It tends to be focused on particular neighborhoods, and I'm pretty focused on the inner city. So mm-hmm. I could talk a little bit about the Good Food Junction research, because it's more than the Good Food Junction. I think that's part of one of the things that what we did with that research is we conceived of it as being focused on the opening of a grocery store, a full service grocery store in a former food desert. But really it's about quite a bit more than that. So one of the things we did was we went door to door within 750 meters of the Good Food Junction itself. So in terms of neighborhood wise, we're talking Pleasant Hill, Riversdale, parts of Meadow Green, a little bit of Meadow Green, a little bit of Westmount, a little bit of Caswell Hill. I think maybe a touch of King George as well. So just neighborhood wise. Mm-hmm. So we went door to door and we asked people a series of questions about how they access food. And we also asked them some demographic questions. So we asked things like what their household income is. And it was a very short survey. We're trying to get in and out of there in 10 minutes and have people be willing to answer our questions. Yeah. And so that in and of itself was a fascinating experience. Mm-hmm. You know, we hired research assistants who are people who are involved in the community, live in the community in some cases, who are people who would be trusted going door to door. And so they went and they asked questions, a whole series of questions. But some of the things we learned were that incomes are really, really low. So close to half of households reported household incomes, annual incomes of less than $30,000 a year. So over a third, less than $20,000 a year. So very, very low household incomes. And when you consider the cost of housing, rental housing, and the vast majority of those people will be in rental housing. Mm-hmm. When you consider the cost of housing in the city, when you're talking about incomes of $20,000-$30,000 a year, chances are those people don't have any money to buy food, let alone to shop at the Good Food Junction, or I mean anywhere else for that matter. So we also found that over 40% of households use some sort of charitable food source. So whether it be the food bank or the Friendship Inn or something similar to that, really, really high. Now the population as a whole across Canada be about 3%. So 40% versus 3%.
Right.
So really high concentration of poverty. But also at the same time, really complex ways of accessing food. So, I mean, in addition to, we ask people how they get to the grocery store to and from. So do you, you know, by what means transportation wise, what's your primary grocery store? Then we ask them about their use of different kinds of food programs. And so we found, you know, over 40% using charitable food sources, but we also found I believe it was close to a third, somewhere between 25% and 30% of households going to the farmer's market. Those are two things side by side that you would really, juxtaposing them, where it's like, really? The same time as we've got such high usage of charitable food sources, we also have use of the farmer's market. Now, geographically speaking, it's close by.
Yeah.
And we didn't ask people what frequency, right? So they may only go once or twice a year. And,
right.
You know, there's that period in September for a couple of weeks where there's some relatively inexpensive produce at the farmer's market. It's pretty short lived. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's what's happening. Maybe people are going they've developed enough knowledge of when to go where, and that is the sense that we have, and that's why we're doing this follow-up research, that people know a lot about how to access food and how to mm-hmm. do it in ways that are inexpensive and that, you know, are able to kind of, as much being very resourceful when right. it comes to acquiring food.
And we're also resourceful is the Laundry List on 90.5 CFCR. And we're talking to Rachel Engler Stringer about food security in Saskatoon. And with me, your host, Lisa. And we're really getting into it and finding out kind of the, I don't know, I'd say the hidden hunger in a lot of ways. Well, that is a terminology used by the World Health Organization and also the World Food Program, this idea of hidden hunger, where there's I think in your case, it's hidden as in people don't realize that it's there, but in like a broader sense, not getting sort of the micronutrients that one needs to have a healthy body and live a healthy life. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so there's this hidden hunger in Saskatoon. So what should listeners what are the concerns, the bigger, broader concerns around not having enough access to food? Like what bigger problems can this cause or issues can it cause?
So starting with the kind of the immediate, the first sort of issues that we would see from a nutritional standpoint. Mm-hmm. So people who are struggling when it comes to having enough money to buy the food that they need to be healthy are going to start by decreasing their vegetable and fruit consumption. So they're not going to be eating what are some of the most nutrient dense foods in our diet?
Is it because they're more expensive or is it because they're not filling?
It's a combination of the two. So there's quite a bit of, it's actually a fascinating body of research to me, the relative, cost of more nutrient dense foods. So, mm-hmm. so for example, you take sort of the example of a bag of carrots, mm-hmm. Versus a bag of potato chips,
right.
And actually, you know, they might be fairly similar in terms of price, although right now maybe carrots might be higher, but you know, typically they might not be that different in terms of the cost of those two.
Right.
But if you look at the number of calories in a bag of carrots compared to what there is in a bag of potato chips and sort of your ability to feel satiated consuming them. So there's this really interesting body of research around the world actually looking at caloric density versus nutrient density. So basically, mm-hmm. foods that are nutritious but don't necessarily have a lot of calories or need to be consumed in conjunction with a number of other foods,
right?
So as part of a meal, mm-hmm. versus foods that are calorie dense, but aren't necessarily nutrient dense. And, mm-hmm. and the literature is quite consistent. There's a mythology out there that you can eat a healthy diet with not very much money.
Yeah, I was going to bring
and,
this up.
And I think it's not, it's a mythology, but it's a complicated mythology in that if you were to consume a diet primarily based on pulses, so meaning lentils mm-hmm. and beans and peas, certain kinds of low-cost vegetables, mm-hmm. And some basic spices and so on, you could eat very well on very little money.
Right.
The problem is that if you look at culturally what our diets are mm-hmm. In North America, that is totally inconsistent with our diet.
Right.
With the
we don't eat pulses
diet.
Here.
We don't eat pulses. And
we grow a lot. We just don't eat them.
Yeah. They take a long time to cook mm-hmm. comparatively. They require a fair bit of skill to mm-hmm. cook.
That, the knowledge of how to use them
exactly.
and how to incorporate them into your recipes.
Exactly. And so people will often say, well, you know, you can eat this healthy diet with very little money and so on. And it's like, well, you know, that is possible in a particular context if people have certain kinds of skills and so on.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of assumptions underneath that. And the people who are struggling the most to feed their families are the same people who don't have the time to do those things.
Yeah, time poverty.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a really, I remember once being at this sort of conference put on by this very famous sort of anti-poverty organization in Montreal called the Montreal Diet Dispensary, which is a really weird name, but it's a very old organization.
Diet's a weird word.
Yeah, it's a very old organization, but they've been around for a really, really long time, well over 100 years, and they're very well known for, they've 100 years they've been giving out milk coupons to low-income women mm-hmm. who are pregnant, and they've got this sort of long, long history. And they partnered with a chef, or it might have been a couple of chefs, and they developed this low-cost menu, mm-hmm. Foods that would be inexpensive but nutritious and be able to provide a healthy diet on a really limited income. And they were giving this talk about how about this menu that they put together, and they were all excited about it. And I kind of felt like the Debbie Downer, because I got up and I said, look, this is really well-meaning, and I think I appreciate where this is coming from. But when I read this menu, what I see is having to spend a great deal of time on cooking, having to have significant knowledge and skill in order to prepare these menus. And we're making assumptions. We're basically saying that if you're poor, something is expected of you that is not expected of the rest of us.
That's a very interesting point.
And I think that is a really, it's really important for us to understand that whether you're poor or you're rich or you're somewhere in between, we all live in the same culture. Mm-hmm. And expecting something different of people because they're low income is not acceptable when we're talking about it from a social justice perspective. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't all change our food culture and all try to consume more pulses and all, you know, all.
But don't point the finger at the people that have the least power in the society to actually make those changes.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we have a few, we have about 5 or so minutes left, and I'd like to get your sort of comments on how you see gender fitting into your research. And also, I'd also like you to quickly comment on what your hopes or dreams or fears are for the new government and maybe their approach to food security in Canada. I said hopes and fear. I don't know how you feel about that, but maybe in comparison to the Harper government, which is no more.
Okay.
And I think for most people, a good thing. Yeah. So let's hear about how you see gender fitting into the discussion that we're having right now in terms of food poverty.
Yeah. So, I think it's pretty central. It isn't always, I'm not always sort of actively thinking about gender in particular, mm-hmm. but when we're talking about families struggling, overwhelmingly we're talking about a burden that's placed on women.
Right.
So whether it be providing food for children or providing food for family as a whole, as much as we'd like to think that our culture has changed around women and men and sharing of those kinds of household roles, the evidence is not does not show that we've gotten to a point of some sort of a really significant sharing in that area. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might be different in certain communities and so on, but overall, we're still in a situation where women are primarily responsible. So when we look at the consequences, so the anxiety, the preoccupation with food, some of the things that we see in households that are struggling, it's women primarily who are experiencing those psychological consequences. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that there's a lot of social pressure on women broadly, including women who are living in poverty, but just broadly, there's a lot of social pressure on women to be the ones to provide healthy diets for their families. Mm-hmm. There's strong moral there's a strong kind of moral element, and mm-hmm. it's heavily gendered.
Yes.
That is, women are supposed to be the ones who ensure that their families are fed. And regardless of the situation, that is actually how the majority of women feel. They feel like it is their responsibility. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, as a result, I think that there's a responsibility to sort of unpack that and think that through and think about what that means for the health of women, the mental health of mm-hmm. women. Move on from there. Mm-hmm. So, it's kind of a short answer, although I could say a lot more on that. But in terms of, and then the second question around government, change in government, Well, I'll be honest, I'm a bit of a cynic when it comes to political parties, and I don't really see a whole lot of difference between them. Mm-hmm. One of the advantages of the current federal government, the new federal government, is at least there's a little bit more of at least lip service to sort of evidence-based decision-making, yeah. a little bit less hostility to yeah. sort of science.
Right.
And I think that you know, that's a positive. So that opens a certain door. One of the things that I've been I've been engaging in a little bit more in the last few months is advocacy work. And I'm actually just right now working on developing a research project around this, but there's this quite significant advocacy work around advocating for a national school food program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important place to put energy. And my hope is that there will be some movement around that. So maybe not, we may not get what most OECD, most sort of relatively well-off countries have, meaning like full-on school lunch programs that are universal.
Right.
But what we might get is we might get a federal government who's willing to mandate certain kinds of policies. We might be able to convince the federal government to mandate even school snack programs. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole other bit of a other conversation, but I see that as really, really critical to both supporting families who are struggling with poverty, but it has to be universal. It cannot be focused only on low-income families.
Right. Yep.
Because of the social justice issue. Mm-hmm. So I see that as being really important from that perspective, but I also see it as being really important to changing food culture and encouraging people to try vegetables and fruit and so on. And so in my mind, there's a really, it's actually really strategic and really key to be talking about things like school meal programs and their importance into the future. And Canada's an exception, right? The vast mm-hmm. majority of countries who are as wealthy as Canada have national school food programs, policies, typically have some sort of a universal school meals program. Even the United States, although it's not done very well, even the United States, we don't want to follow their example, but even they have it. And yet in Canada, we don't. So
right.
I see that as being a potential opening door with the current federal government. There's some other things as well, but my hope is that there might be some movement on that over the next few years.
Well, yeah, let's cross our fingers and hope that they make good on some of their promises. We're unfortunately out of time. I can't even believe it. We didn't even get to talk about your trip to Uganda. Next time, we'll have to have a part two. But I'd like to thank you on behalf of the Laundry List. Thanks for coming in and telling us more about food security in Saskatoon and just kind of more generally like what it's about and your research. So thanks very much for coming in, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, you're listening to 90.5 CFCR, The Laundry List. And this is Lisa saying goodnight.